WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Was born in 1890, E. Raymond Wilson was born in 1896. They've each devoted most of their adult lives to the peace movement. They've worked for peace during world wars and during smaller wars. They've tried to strengthen international understanding during times of peace. When they join us in about 45 minutes, we'll discuss the decades they've devoted to working for peace. With me is someone whose name has been associated with the peace movement since the Vietnam War, Reverend William Sloan Coffin. After serving as an officer in the infantry during World War II, he joined the CIA, for whom he was based in Germany from 50 to 53 on a top-secret assignment. He decided to resign from the CIA to pursue religious work. He graduated from the Yale Divinity School in 1956. During the war in Vietnam, he was the Protestant chaplain at Yale. It was during this period he also founded the peace group Clergy and Laity Concerned. Since 1977, he's been the senior minister at the Riverside Church in New York. He recently served on the President's Advisory Council on the Peace Corps. His books include Sermons and Books and Once to Every Man. You'll recall that he was also one of the ministers who flew to Iran for Christmas with the hostages in 1980. He's very concerned with peace and disarmament and lectures frequently on the subject. Yesterday he spoke at the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania campus. The subject was the arms race and the human race. This was part of a series called Personal Values and Public Policy. And if you'd perhaps like to attend some of the other upcoming talks in this series, they will include talks by Robert Edgar, Maggie Kuhn, and Baruch Bloomberg. And if you'd like any more information about the series, you can call the Christian Association at 386-1530, and I'll give that number again a little later. Well, Reverend William Sloan Coffin, it's really a great pleasure to meet you, and I'm very glad you were able to be with us today.
Ms. Terry Gross, it's a great pleasure to meet you.
Can we hear about how your religious life and work for peace came together? Were they always together for you?
No. I guess I always, when I was younger, I thought religion was pretty irrelevant. I thought most people's religion never took them beyond the garden gate. So I really had very little to do with religion when I was young. And then I realized the folly of my ways and that biblical insights can inform public life as well as private life. And now I'm more and more convinced that biblical insights have a lot to say about the whole issue of, let's say, poverty, the whole issue of war and peace.
What are some examples of that? What are some passages from
the Bible?
Well,
let's say something on poverty. When I was in public school as a kid, I was taught there are rich people and there are poor people, no connection. Now, if you read the Bible, you read that there are poor people because there are rich people. The poor are not a problem to the rich. It's always the rich who are a problem to the poor, and that God is fundamentally on both sides, but his heart's a little to the left. That is, his heart is with the poor. So there's a whole understanding of poverty and riches in the Bible, which is much tighter than I think we generally appreciate in public school. And then on things like war and peace, the Bible takes a very jaundiced view of power. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor, laments Ezekiel over Tyre. Or in the New Testament, one of the big temptations to Jesus is power, seeking status through power. The devil says, all these kingdoms of the world I will give to you if you will worship me. Now, seeking status through power is a terrible temptation for a nation as powerful as the United States or the Soviet Union. So you get a lot of passages in the Bible that really help you, I think, understand some of the temptations of nations as well as some of the temptations of individuals.
From what I've been reading about you and following about you in the news, it seems that peace work is really, as far as issues go, one of your, if not the chief concern of yours.
Well, I think it's the meat and potato issue of the day, and it's on the plate of every Christian. That is, if we don't stop the momentum of the arms race and we don't somehow disarm the world, at least as far as nuclear weapons go, there won't be any other issues to trouble us.
You were very active in the campaign against the war in Vietnam. Was working then for peace and working now for peace very different?
No, I don't think it was. I think the same pride that I was talking about before was very much involved in the United States' unilateral, massive intervention in the internal affairs of another country, deciding who lives, dies, and rules in a small country 8,000 miles away. That takes a good deal of national pride to do that. And I think you can see that same national pride at work now in Reagan's insistence that we be number one. We're not talking about negotiation. We're talking about peace through military preeminence. And the drive to be number one is all right on the football field, or tonight between the Dodgers and the Yankees, but it's lethal in the nuclear age when one nation insists on being number one and another nation says, we're going to catch up with you.
You've had a chance to take inventory of the different actions that were done during the war in Vietnam, the marches and sit-ins and rebellion staged on campuses. Looking back, what do you think were some of the most effective tactics and some of the least effective tactics?
Well, I think one of the most effective things was when the business community came to the realization that the war in Vietnam for the first time was uneconomical. I say for the first time, it's the first war in American history that was economically bad for the nation. And I think the rest of us did what we could, but I have a feeling that the business community was the most influential in keeping that war from escalating too high. And I wish the business community would realize that a nuclear exchange would be very bad for their markets. They should be leading the drive to try to work disarmament rather than greater armament. Now, the rest of us don't have access to the lobbies in the same way. You know, poor people, young people take to the streets because there's no other place for them to go. And that's fine. The 250,000 who demonstrated in September in Washington certainly said something to the nation. I think that was a very effective gathering. And I think it'll be an effective gathering next month when the women, group of women, go down to Washington, and I think they're going to commit civil disobedience. And then we have an armaments conference, which will certainly bring about 1,000 people, and we're going down to lobby the Congress, which I think is something that needs to be done. Congress people need to think that they can oppose arms budgets without committing political suicide. And the best way to convince them is to show up as a large number of their constituents and tell them, look, we're on your side. You can vote against this without losing the next election.
You mentioned the importance of the business community in ending the war in Vietnam, and in this case, in as you put it, recognizing that nuclear war would be bad for their markets. Do you have any ways of trying to discuss things with the business community?
I had a very interesting lunch with two executive vice presidents of a big bank in New York at their initiative, and they simply wanted a frank exchange of views. And when I asked them to declare themselves in the arms race, they said, frankly, we couldn't get back to headquarters if we said the things about the arms race that you do. I said, in other words, belonging to the bank means you sold your American birthright. You can't claim your rights as an American citizen to speak your mind. I said, why don't you go into the bank president and say, I love my bank, but I love my country, and as an American citizen, I have a right to express myself, and I'm going to forget that we're even having this conversation, you know. And they said, well, the next day we'd be fired. I said, well, suppose you said to him, and if you fire me, I'll call a press conference, and I'll write up this whole thing. They laughed, and they said, we'd still be fired, which is rather sad that people who are at the top of the business world simply were not as free to express themselves as a preacher or a talk show hostess like you, you know. I mean, that's kind of sad, but that's the fact. Now, they said, you'll notice that Wall Street is opposing Reagan on economic grounds without mentioning the military. But we all know that the military budget is highly inflationary and his economics will never work as long as we're increasing the military budget. But we'd rather simply say this is bad economics without spelling out the reason.
You know what I found kind of fascinating, I think it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, the company, and I forget which it was, that expected to get the contract for building the stealth bomber, had hundreds of engineers camping outside its gates waiting to file job applications.
Yeah.
And for engineers who are some of the most highly trained people in the country to be camping out waiting for jobs, and to have those jobs be in the defense industry was
very interesting. Well, and this is another thing I think that we have to recognize, just as it used to be that the more weapons you had around, the more national security you had. It used to be that the arms industry was good for the economy and that it supplied a lot of jobs. It's a terrible thing to say, you know. I mean, it's like having a lot of empty hospital beds and saying, well, we better have a plague here so we can fill up the hospital beds. But at least it used to be the case. Now, just as there is no national security in the nuclear age, and military superiority is at the expense of really of national security. That's what most Americans haven't taken in yet. We're going for military superiority at the expense of security. So most Americans haven't taken in the fact that the arms industry is now so capital intensive as opposed to labor intensive that most of our taxpayers' money goes to providing jobs for very expensive machines rather than for human beings. So this is a very inefficient way to provide jobs. And if you look at Grumman in Long Island, you see that profits go up, but the jobs are falling off. And this is true in McDonnell Douglas and St. Louis and Boeing in the far west. So that it's not good for the economy. And these engineers lining up are a statement of the fact that for highly trained engineers, there will be jobs, but not for less highly trained workers. And, of course, I couldn't help noticing here in Philadelphia how the Japanese have already taken over your trolley market now. I was stunned to see that. We don't have any Japanese buses and trolleys yet in New York. But that's because the Japanese aren't making arms, and the West Germans aren't making arms. So they're coming in and taking all our automobile market and now even the trolley market here in Philadelphia.
Wait, what's the connection?
Because they're not, all their engineers aren't working in defense. Their best brains are in the automobile industry and consumer products and cameras, radios, televisions. So they're just taking American markets right away from us. And we have only ourselves to blame because our best brains and our money is being invested in arms industry. So more and more Americans are buying not only cars that come from Japan and West Germany, but even trolley cars. I hadn't seen that before coming here.
I'd like to get back for a second to what you were saying before about business and how you think business should have a vested interest in ensuring peace. Multinationals actually do have branches in so many different countries that the way our country might define allies and enemies might really not pertain to a multinational who has branches in countries that would come under both of those categories.
Well, I think it's a mixed thing. I think we have to say, honestly, as Americans, that we are very imperialistic in the sense that we don't want to so much control territory, but we want to control resources. The big thing now is to control resources, so we announce that we're, if necessary, going to invade Saudi Arabia, if necessary, invade Iran. We'll do anything we can to protect our resources. Now, in that sense, the multinationals who are involved in these resources want the military to protect their lifeline as they see it. On the other hand, they must know that an ever-escalating arms race in terms of nuclear weapons is presenting a fantastic danger that an exchange could be set off by accident. I mean, it only takes missiles, you know, 25 minutes now to go door to door. And pretty soon we'll have to adopt what's called a launch upon warning strategy, which is to say we'll have to give the decision-making power over to these computers, which make mistakes. And the whole thing could be started by a mistake when some computer misreads 15 geese flying happily south over Philadelphia on a nice Indian summer afternoon and thinks that that's the missiles coming in, and off go the missiles, and the other side releases its missiles. Now, businessmen must know that there's a terrible danger of that. And so I would think when it came to nuclear arms that they would really be in the forefront of the debate about the wisdom of more and more and more of them.
I'm speaking with Reverend William Sloan Coffin, if you're just joining us. So what do you think is most within your power to do in your work for peace?
Well, I think that the religious community is the community most concerned at this moment about this issue. I've been part of I guess, over 200 conferences that have brought up to 1,000 people and in such places as Pasadena, California. I think that many good Christians are really thinking that this is indeed should be a serious concern of the church. I'm very moved by the Archbishop of Seattle, who opposed the nuclear weapons. He was joined by the Archbishop, Roman Catholic Archbishop of San Francisco, who said the mere possession of these weapons is immoral. And I personally feel that the acceptance of nuclear weapons is as spiritually devastating in our time as the acceptance of slaves was in the last century. And then you may remember that the Bishop of Amarillo, Texas, Roman Catholic Bishop of Amarillo, Texas, where the neutron bomb is assembled, came out against the neutron bomb, said it was immoral, and was supported by the other bishops of Texas. Now, the academic community hasn't begun to show this kind of signs of life. The labor community, with the exception of William Wimpersinger, hasn't begun to show this kind of interest. Physicians are beginning to come alive now. The dean of the Harvard Medical School is the head of what's called Physicians for Social Responsibility, and this marvelous Australian pediatrician, Dr. Helen Caldicott, has taken 2 years off from her normal work simply to talk about the devastating effects of a nuclear exchange. Now, when doctors begin to talk that way, and bishops begin to talk that way, when labor catches on, and if the academics ever come to life, then I think we'll see some real changes in this country. I'm more encouraged now than I was before Reagan, because I think Reagan is making the case, and it's going to be Reagan who shows that you can't rob the poor to feed the military without the poor getting organized and without the whole economy getting fouled up. So in a way, he's like the Shah. He's uniting the opposition in a way that the opposition couldn't unite without him.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up. In Iran, when the Americans were being held hostage, I know a lot of the people who went over there and visited, either like you, to meet with the hostages, or other people who just went on like peace journeys, some of whom were from Philadelphia. Some of them who returned felt that that the Ayatollah was really okay, and that this was a movement in the right direction, and maybe he was being a little extreme, but that you had to be extreme at first and that things would work out for the benefit of the Iranians. What do you think now, looking back?
Well,
now
I was never that
optimistic.
Yeah. I know too much church history to know that clerics don't belong in power.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do very well. We belong in the opposition. We do much better as gadflies than we do running a country. So I was never that optimistic about the Ayatollah. I thought Bonnie Sada was our best bet and that we should have done far more to help him. And if we had been a little more flexible, I think we would have had the hostages out long ago, long before they did come out. My feeling on that situation was that it was like a terrible divorce where both sides feel so wronged that neither can conceive of having done any wrong. The United States could only see 52 hostages as a thorn in the flesh and thought the Iranians were totally wrong, not to say evil, to do a thing like that, and that was the end of it. When you talk to the Iranians, all they could see was 25 years under the Shah, the United States supporting the Shah long after he'd lost the support of his own citizens, Carter having sent $8 billion worth of arms during his last year, and there are people being tortured in prisons built with American money and killed on the streets with weapons made in the United States, often mounted on tanks made by Chrysler. That's all they could see. And if I said to these Ayatollahs that I tried to, there's a heavy irony in here, brothers, because there were no sisters, you are reelecting your own archenemy. I mean, Carter was nothing in the polls until you took hostages. And now he's standing a good chance of being reelected. But they couldn't see the irony. They were so angry, you know, at the United States. It was a sad situation. Then you come back and try to explain their point of view, and you're accused of being brainwashed.
Did the fact that you're a person of religion help you become any closer to the Iranian Revolution when you visited there than would have been for politicians and diplomats?
I don't think it would have made much difference. And we were only there, 2-3 days. You know, when I would point out this irony to these mullahs, their response was, you will go back to your people, you will be a prophet to your people and speak the truth, you will be prepared to die in the best Christian tradition. That is your role as a Christian minister. And I'd say, okay, I will try to fulfill my role and be a prophet to my people, speak the truth, and be ready to die in the best Christian tradition. But I'll tell you something else, brothers. You are going to reelect Carter, you know. But I couldn't dent them, you know. There was no room for any kind of humor or irony. They reminded me a lot of Jerry Falwell. Same kind of self-righteousness, you know. No room for
Well, they're both fundamentalists.
Yeah. See, in a very uncertain world, the anguish of uncertainty, the feeling people have of being dispossessed by change makes people engage in what psychiatrists call premature closure, which is a nice phrase. It means just they start pounding the Bible or pounding the Constitution, pounding the table and say, well, this is it. We want our answers clean, neat, and simple. And here it is. And Reagan, in his way, is kind of an ideological fundamentalist. You know, he says this is the whole country's going to be just fine. The whole world's going to be just fine as long as the United States does this, that, and the other. And this, that, and the other are not complicated enough.
It's so a very interesting complex that, world. That people in America and people in the Middle East, not everybody, but a lot of people in both parts of the world are turning towards fundamentalist religions. You know, of course, here there's not an aim to take over the government with fundamentalists. I mean, there's not a revolution being staged, a fundamentalist revolution or anything.
But the important word, I think, is more fundamentalist than religion, because you have fundamentalist Marxist, you can have fundamentalist scientists, you can have almost fundamentalism springs, I think, from psychological soil, and it's this soil of insecurity that makes people then leap for simple, easy answers or engage in unproductive nostalgia for past times that were never really that good anyhow.
I think in the Middle East, the fundamentalists who have come into or are seeking to come into power are blurring all the distinctions people like to make between the right and the left. Because, you know, you have this revolution identified with radicalism and the left, staged by fundamentalists identified with conservatism. And it's very difficult to understand, I think.
I think what's important to understand, though, is that the popularity of fundamentalist Islam is today is that it carries a lot of social justice freight. I mean, it's really insisting on distribution of wealth on a much more equitable grounds, you know. And reason poor Sadat couldn't seem to make it very well at home was that the rich were getting richer, the very few were getting richer, and the vast population was getting poorer. And that's also soil for kind of left-wing, proper left-wing fundamentalism. So they can be very conservative theologically and quite radical politically almost. But I must say, simplistic ideas in the long run are very disillusioning, and answers that purport to clear up too much always end up by showing to having too little to offer. But I think that's the hardest thing to live with is uncertainty. That's a measure of a nation's maturity. A measure of the nation's maturity is its ability to live with uncertainty.
When you're at the church, how do you work in your politics and you work for peace into your day-to-day work at the church?
Well, we have, religion takes many expressions. It takes a lot of education has to be done, Bible study and meditation and things like that. Spiritual life has to be developed in every individual. You know, it's pastoral counseling center we have at the church. You know, that too is an expression of the faith. And then we try also to carry our commitments to God into public life. I mean, to work for New York City, you know, where the poor are becoming modern-day lepers. And so we have charitable programs. We give away food 2 hours a day, and we give away free clothing twice a week. But we try to go beyond charity, which only seeks to alleviate the results of poverty, but doesn't deal with the causes of poverty, and to get into areas of justice, which then means you have to talk about redistribution of power, redistribution of wealth on a more equitable basis. So there's a whole thrust of social justice, and that's in the political field. And then we have this program, brilliantly run by Cora Weiss, which is basically an educational resource for all churches and synagogues across the country on the arms race. We have material on the economic aspects, on the technological aspects, the theological aspects, you name it, we got it.
What's the neighborhood like that you serve?
It's sort of mixed. It used to be a rather wealthy one around the university, but now it's fallen on rather harder times. It's almost all Spanish-speaking around the church and where I live, which is only three blocks away. We have 1 million people who are muy bien español in New York now, a whole million. It's really a terrific addition in a way. You know, you feel almost culturally deprived if you don't speak Spanish and you don't get into some of that marvelously rich Spanish.
Do you speak Spanish?
Yeah, I speak it some. I've learned it because I felt culturally deprived without it.
So what's the population like who actually attends?
We're now 35% black, and there are no very rich people there, but they tend to be fairly well educated. And they're very dedicated to the city. The deacons voted 100% for our disarmament program. We call it reverse the arms race because we're not advocating unilateral disarmament. And it's a very dedicated crowd.
I know the church holds meetings for lesbian and gays.
Oh, yeah. We have a group of gays and lesbians, and they're very accepted in the church.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because, you know, some churches are prepared for that and others really aren't, you know, as far as the constituency
right.
of the church.
Well, I gave a whole sermon on homosexuality based primarily on a glorious book written by a Yale professor named Boswell, which shows, and you didn't need to read the book to know this, that the moral majority totally misconstrues the Bible when it comes to their attacks on homosexuality. There is nothing, for instance, in the Bible that refers to people whose sexual orientation is homosexual. The Bible assumes that all homosexual acts are performed by heterosexual people, and therefore there's nothing in the Bible that addresses a patently loving, faithful relationship between two women or two men. It's simply not addressed. And probably Sodom and Gomorrah had nothing to do with homosexuality and had much more to do with the law of hospitality, which was violated, which you can check in Luke 10. Now that I debate Falwell, I can tell you where anything is in the Bible, you know, zing, zing, zing.
Have you been on the circuit debating him?
No, not on the circuit. It's too boring. But once with Donahue, I have great sympathy with the followers because of the psychological insecurity I feel in them. But the leaders like Falwell are shameful in their misuse of Scripture and unbelievably petty in their selection of issues which they consider to be key, which have nothing to do with issues of war and peace, have nothing to do with issues of poverty, you know, these big issues that are tearing our poor planet apart.
How would you debate them?
Well, for instance, on the homosexuality, you know, I'd do it on biblical line. I gave him this book, and he said, you know, typically he said, but I'm not an Eastern intellectual like you, Bill. And I said, I know, Jerry, you're an ignoramus, so I'm asking you only to read this one chapter because you're always quoting the Bible. Now you ought to know what you're talking about. You know, you can be Bible-centered and not biblically informed. And so, you know, we can talk about what the Bible says and time. I'll give you another example. They think the death sentence is justified because it's in the Bible. So I simply say, okay, I'm going to name for you all the sins which in biblical time were punishable by death. And I want you to tell me whether you want the death sentence reinstituted in the following cases. We'll start with adultery. Yes or no? You want the death sentence reinstituted? Yeah. Now, if you're going to say justify the death sentence because it's in the Bible as far as murder goes, you better be consistent. Say adultery, bearing false witness against your neighbor, so forth. You know, I don't hold the followers responsible, but I think the leaders are shameless.
As a religious leader, what do you think of television religion programming now?
They're very boring for the most part. And they don't take on the controversial issues either. You know, the nails will never graze the palms of these televangelists, or whatever we want to call them. They give people basically what people want to hear and not what they really need to hear. And that's a misuse of the faith.
Have you or other people within the religious community who are working for peace issues ever considered trying to secure television time and to have... like a half-hour spot Friday nights at 9 or anything like that. Do you think that that would be a valuable thing?
Yeah, there's some people who have urged us to do that. Personally, it means a lot of time raising that kind of money for causes which as yet are not that popular. I don't like going to church on television. I think that one of the reasons they're so popular, these people, is that they've mastered the art of the pastoral visit via the media. So here I am, an old man sitting at home and singing to myself, bye-bye happiness, hello loneliness, I think I'm going to die. And here comes Jerry Falwell, you know, looking cheerful and credible and handsome, and he looks at me through that big tube and he says, Jesus loves you, Bill, and so do I. And I feel good. He makes me feel good. Yeah, he doesn't make me think. He doesn't make me self-critical. He doesn't make me skeptical of our national policies or any of those things. You know, he just makes me feel real good. So when he says, send me your $15, I send him. Now, we couldn't do that, you see. We couldn't just go around and tell everybody, make them feel good, send us $15, and then we'll tell you something you don't want to hear.
I guess that would be a problem. You mentioned self-criticism and skepticism. Are those important parts of religion?
Oh, I think faith is always accompanied by doubt. Otherwise, it's not a considered faith.
Why? Because, a lot of people would have you believe otherwise.
Yeah, but that's premature closure. And, of course, to me, the integrity of love is always more important than the purity of dogma. Dogma is a signpost pointing beyond itself, not a hitching post. And true faith is the recognition that the revelation is love. The revelation is therefore discovered in the relationship with God when one prays and talks to God and believes that Jesus Christ is essentially God's love in person on earth. And if Christ is God's love personified, then the church is God's love organized. And we're supposed to be seeing what we can do to make the love of God more manifest around the world and not get hung up indefinitely on minutiae of dogma.
Are you interested in, converting, either in converting people or in reaching people who've never considered themselves religious and having them find faith and become religious?
Now, of course, I'm interested in converting people in the sense that if you have a beautiful cake, and you don't offer it to anybody, why, you've missed the point of having a beautiful cake. All you can do, though, is offer it. You can't force feed the faith with any integrity. But I also keep asking not only who believes in God, but in whom does God believe? And I better get with those folk. And if faith is being grasped by the power of love, manifestly there are many faithful people who are doing God's work, even though they may say, we don't believe in God. But if God believes in them, that's more important.
Have you made any changes within the service at Riverside Church? Are there new songs or additions of new prayers or anything like that? Or do you find that unnecessary?
Well, it's a little perhaps livelier now, you know. I mean, we have spots. Maya Angelou, this great, wonderful, I was going to say black writer, but she's not a black writer, she's not a woman writer, she's just a fantastic writer whose roots get right down into universal soil. She took 10 minutes in the service a couple of weeks ago. She was at the church the whole weekend. And it was marvelous. She just read from her I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, you know, the revival meeting. Then she started to sing, you know, and it came the time. The whole church was really just clicking right along. It was a wonderful expression of joy, you know. And as times get worse, we try to make the service more and more joyful without being shallow in our joy, but profoundly joyful. Despite everything, we can go on. We're not going to hand over our high morale to the United States government. We're going to leave it strictly with the Lord. This kind of stuff, you know, so that people are encouraged to be better as times get worse.
Have you dealt with the question of gender and language?
We try to be as inclusive as possible, referring to God as she, some of the time as well as he. We have women ministers on the staff, and when they pray, why they're up there praying mightily is, you know, to God as she, though I think it's important that the men do that also. In the hymns, we encourage people to substitute their own languages if it gets painful. And often what it does is sort of increase the singing because the old-timers who don't want to mess around with the words find themselves singing louder against these feminists who insist on changing these words, so the whole volume of the singing goes up a bit. It's one of these things you have to live with. You can't resolve it, and it's very creative, the kind of conflict that it produces. I welcome that. I think that's healthy.
Do you think he or she misses the boat?
Well, obviously God is beyond gender. But to refer to, but if God is experienced in your life as personal power, as a loving power, you've got to find a word for God which reflects more nearly that experience of a loving power. And so to talk about God as Father and talk about God as Mother is a much better way of talking about God than is talking about God as an unmoved mover or it or something like that. So I would much rather refer to God as Mother than not to refer to God as a person, although, of course, we understand that we're simply, this is imaginative use of language to try and express something which is fundamentally a mystery.
So what do you see ahead for yourself for, say, the next year in terms of peace activities? Do you know what kind of work you're going to be engaged in?
Well, our primary responsibility is in the religious community, so we'll be encouraging more and more conferences of the kind we'll have this next week, November 15th, at Riverside. We'll bring more and more people from abroad because the internationalization of the movement is very important. I was asked to speak at that big rally in Bonn a couple of weeks ago. I wasn't able to do it and get back in time to preach on Sunday, so I figured I couldn't do it. But I will be going to a conference, the World Council of Churches, in late November in Amsterdam. And we're bringing a woman from England, Mary Caldor, to our conference because the Europeans are ahead of us. They realize how dangerous these nuclear weapons are more than we do, and they realize that, as one of them said, a limited nuclear war would be limited to us. And they see themselves now as becoming perhaps the victims of nuclear exchange.
If any of us residents from the Delaware Valley go to New York, is it okay to just stop in on a Sunday or whenever to the church?
Absolutely. If you don't feel welcome, then we're not being the church. And it'd be just lovely to have folks in the Delaware Valley.
Well, I don't have the address handy. Maybe you could just tell us.
490 Riverside Drive.
Okay, and that's the Riverside Church. Well,
that's
Riverside Church. Well, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. And let me simply say to nice people out there, if you can't be optimistic, you have to be persistent. And we'll just have to keep hanging in there without losing our high hearts.
Okay, thanks.
Very nice to be here.
I've been speaking with Reverend William Sloan Coffin, and what brought him to Philadelphia was a talk that he gave yesterday at the Christian Association. And he's, of course, been associated with the peace movement for many years, beginning with the Vietnam War, and he's now with the Riverside Church, and as you've heard, does a lot of touring, speaking at peace gatherings and speaking at colleges. This series that he spoke at last night is called Personal Values and Public Policy, and the idea is to bring people who've taken open stands for peace or justice issues and to ask them how they arrived at those stands and how that fits in with the other aspects of their professional life. Coming up in this series will be Congressman Bob Edgar, Maggie Kuhn of the Gray Panthers, and scientist Dr. Burek Bloomberg, who's the associate director of the Institute for Cancer Research at the Fox Chase Medical Center. I'll just give you a phone number if you'd like to see any of these other discussions. You can call the Christian Association at 386-1530, 386-1530, and they'll give you more information. Again, thanks to you for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's 16 minutes to 3, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to continue talking about work for peace, and I'll be joined by two guests who have devoted most of the 20th century working for peace. And my guests will be Ray Wilson and Mildred Scott Olmsted, who've, as I said, been spending most of the century working for peace. That's coming up in about 5 minutes.